Third case in this extended session of court is United States v. Armstrong. Is appellant ready to argue?
Yes, sir.
The government?
Yes, sir.
Okay, appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Joshua Fix. Together with Captain Zachary Gray, we represent the appellant, Captain Joseph Armstrong. Chief Judge Stuckey, with your permission, we request 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
This court should set aside and dismiss the appellant's conviction of assault consummated by a battery because it was not a lesser-included offense of abusive sexual contact under the Jones elemental analysis.
Could you speak up a little, counsel?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Further, the appellant urges this court to apply and extend the reasoning of U.S. v. Reese and hold that the defect in this case was in fact jurisdictional because assault consummated by a battery was never properly referred to court-martial under Article 79, and RCM 201 Bravo 3 limits court-martial jurisdiction to offenses properly referred. Pending any preliminary questions from the court, I will turn to the discussion of error. Now, assault consummated by a battery requires a harmful or offensive touching, that is the bodily harm element, done by unlawful force or violence. And this court has also held that non-consent is an element of assault consummated by a battery. By contrast, abusive sexual contact requires sexual contact, which is a defined term, by means of bodily harm or harmful or offensive touching. Unless the harmful or offensive touching is charged as the non-consensual sexual contact, non-consent is not an element of abusive sexual contact, nor is unlawful force or violence. And it is in this way that the offense was charged in this case. It was charged not as a non-consensual sexual contact. It was charged by this other bodily harm. So the non-consent was not an element as charged.
Counsel, just to clarify, how would it have to have been charged such that it would have been, the consent element would have been met, putting aside the unlawful force?
In order for the consent element to be met, Your Honor, it would have to be charged as, it would be a bodily harm, to wit, the non-consensual touching of Mrs. BG's genitals. And that is a charging scheme that you see at the trial level, and I believe this court sees on appellate review fairly frequently. It is an allowed charging scheme, and it simply was not used in this court, or in this case, rather. Of course, that is, as Your Honor says, aside from the element of unlawful force or violence. So assault consummated by a battery.
Let me raise an ugly specter. The defense requested an instruction that said, that assumed basically that it was an LIO. Then, when asked by the military judge directly, what's your position on whether it's an LIO, the defense said, taking no position on it, Your Honor. Why isn't that explicit waiver?
I have four answers for that, Your Honor.
Well, let me have
saw
at least,
that coming, huh?
Let me see at least hear at least one.
Okay. So, as a preliminary matter, Your Honor, the requested instructions do not request a LIO. They request a particular instruction in case of an LIO, and it seems possible that this is an
The way I read the requested instruction is it assumes it's an LIO. And then ask a question in light of that.
Yes, Your Honor. But the defense is allowed to make either argument or requests in the alternative. And that gets to my next of those four responses, is that the defense was explicitly asked, do you see any LIOs? And this is before the instructions phase, after the appellant has explained that he has exercised his Fifth Amendment right not to testify on his own behalf. And the defense is asked, do you see any LIOs? And the defense counsel says no. And then the court asks the government, government, do you see any LIOs? And the government explains, yes, we believe Article 120 is an LIO. Here's why we believe that. And the court then goes back to the defense counsel, and the defense counsel, and I believe this is a quote, Your Honor, rather unhelpfully says, taking no position on it, judge. Now, in context, it's the appellant's position that he need not have said no a second time to preserve the no. He was asked on the record, his counsel was asked on the record, do you see any LIOs? And the answer was no. If anything, so it's the appellant's position, this is actually preserved by that no. But if not preserved, then it is forfeit and not waived. And that is for two reasons. The first one is that stating taking no position on it is not the intentional relinquishment of a known right. It is an explanation of, I have nothing further to add. And so even if this is...
Well, or it's an explanation of, I don't want to commit myself.
Potentially, Your Honor. I mean, this is somewhat speculative, and I understand that. Like I said, a statement like that helps neither the trial judge nor this court. And the appellant's aware of that. But in the context of the preceding no, that is not waiver. If anything, it is forfeiture. But that's not the only reason that it's forfeiture. It's also forfeiture for the same reason that this court explained in U.S. v. Oliver, that at the time of this trial, which was pre-Riggins, the case law was unclear on this issue. And so for the same reason that an explicit no objection in Oliver was found to be not waiver but forfeiture, and I understand your concurrence, Chief Judge Stuckey, took exception with that. But for the same reason as in Oliver, this also is not waiver, but if anything, forfeiture. However, it is the appellant's position that it is preserved. And, of course, the appellant's argument regarding whether or not it deprived the court-martial of jurisdiction is sort of an overlay on top of that, where if this court agrees with that argument, then it need not address the waiver versus forfeiture issue in this case, because it would either it would be unwaivable or certainly it could not be procedurally waived. Now, moving back to the error issue, if I may, as we've just discussed, assault consummated by a battery has two elements that are not found in abusive sexual contact as it was charged in this case: unlawful force or violence and non-consent. Now, it's useful to juxtapose this situation with this court's opinion in U.S. v. Bonner, where this court concluded that assault consummated by a battery was a lesser-included offense of wrongful sexual contact. Wrongful sexual contact, however, was unique under the 2000, what I'll refer to as the 2007 Article 120, in that wrongful sexual contact explicitly included a non-consent element. And if you go to the 2007 version of Article 120 and Article 120 Romeo, this court will find that the subsection of Article 120 discussing wrongful sexual contact is the only one singled out as including a non-consent element, and it's stated that non-consent is not an element of any other offense listed under 120. Abusive sexual contact was already an offense under Article 120, even under that version of the code, and in substantially it's the same form. Now, in the 2012 changes to the UCMJ, wrongful sexual contact was done away with, and a new type of bodily harm was allowed statutorily. That was bodily harm where the bodily harm is the non-consensual sexual act. But as charged in this case, there is nothing meaningful to distinguish between the elements of abusive sexual contact as they existed in 2007 and the elements of abusive sexual contact in 2012 as they were charged in this case. Now, in U.S. v. Riggins, this court held that assault consummated by a battery is not a lesser-included offense of abusive sexual contact by placing another in fear. In Riggins, this court highlighted that the element of non-consent, that neither the element of non-consent nor the element of unlawful force or violence were found in the charged offense in Riggins. And while the charged offense in this case includes an element of bodily harm, that is a harmful or offensive touching, It plainly does not include the element that bodily harm be done with unlawful force or violence. So when you match these two statutes up, there is only one element that they share, and that is the element of bodily harm.
Counsel, my understanding is unlawful force was not defined in the 2012 manual. What is the definition of unlawful force? I know we defined it in Bonner, but could it be so broad as to be force without consent? I think Bonner said it was any no legally cognizable reason for it.
As a matter of fact, Your Honor, unlawful force is actually statutorily defined in the version of Article 120.
In 120, but not 128.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. And so I'm sorry, Your Honor, I misunderstood your question then.
My question is, what is the meaning of unlawful force in 128?
So if I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, and please correct me if I'm going astray of your intent here, unlawful force means essentially the same thing as it is defined as in Article 120, which is force done with act without legal justification or excuse. Now, there's a slight spin on that in 120 because of course, in 120, force is also defined in a way that is different from 128, but without legal justification or excuse would be the definition as the appellant understands it. Did that answer your question, Your Honor? And so you have these two elements that are still missing. For this reason, it is the appellant's position that abusive sexual contact did not include these elements, and assault consummated by a battery was therefore not a lesser included offense as charged. Now, pending any questions from this court on the error issue, I'd like to turn briefly to jurisdiction and then prejudice if this court disagrees on jurisdiction. Based on this court's reasoning in Reese and the language of Article 79 and RCM 201 Bravo 3, this court should find that the defect in this case was jurisdictional. Article 79 confers courts-martial jurisdiction over offenses necessarily included in referred offenses. An offense, however, is not necessarily included if it has additional elements. Necessarily included means an LIO. And so if this is not an LIO, then it is not properly referred to the court-martial along with the supposedly greater offense under Article 79. RCM 201 Bravo 3 limits the jurisdiction of a court-martial to offenses referred to it by a competent authority. And so, Your Honors, if the offense was never referred, then under RCM 201 Bravo 3, the court-martial simply did not have proper jurisdiction over the offense. And we understand that this would be an expansion of current case law, but it would be in keeping with the first principles, as Judge Stuckey mentioned in argument earlier today, and it would be in keeping with this court's reasoning in U.S. v. Reese. Pending any questions on that, I would like to turn briefly to prejudice, should this court apply a prejudice analysis in any event. Now, if this court moves to prejudice, there are two paths that it can take. It's the appellant's position that this was, in fact, preserved error because the appellant's counsel was asked whether or not there were any LIOs, and the appellant's counsel said no, and no means no. And the appellant's counsel should not have had to elaborate any further in order to preserve the potential error, particularly given the uncertain situation with case law at the time, pre-Riggins. But even if this court finds that this was not preserved error and therefore analyzes this under the plain error analysis, the appellant was prejudiced. His material, his right to notice was prejudiced. And it's instructive to compare this case to Oliver, which I mentioned earlier, I believe. In Oliver, this court found that there was no prejudice because the appellant in that case put on a defense of consent. That was his theory of defense. And so nothing would have meaningfully changed in the appellant's case because the non-consent element, and that's what this court focused on, was already defended against. In this case, the appellant put forth a defense of, I did not touch her genitals. That was the appellant's theory of the case, was that the alleged sexual contact never occurred, or if it did occur, it was an accident that he was unaware of. But it didn't occur. That's the appellant's position. And he put forward multiple experts to testify about this. There was DNA involved. And he did not present a defense as to consent or the potential lawfulness of what he was doing. Pending any questions from this court, it is for these reasons that the appellant requests this court to set aside and dismiss the findings.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Cassandra Esposo, and along with Major Cormac Smith, I represent the government. This court should affirm the findings and sentence for two reasons. First, the military judge did not err when he determined battery was a lesser-included offense of abusive sexual contact. And second, appellant failed to show that he was substantially prejudiced as a result of any error. First, appellant was placed on notice of the non-consensual nature and physical contact required by both abusive sexual contact and the lesser-included offense of assault consummated by battery. Now, when conducting the assessment, the language does not need to be identical between the two offenses. Here, as stated, the proof of the elements of abusive sexual contact by bodily harm necessarily required proof of the elements of assault consummated by battery. For abusive sexual contact, the...
Captain Esposa, could you move your microphone a little closer?
My apologies, Your Honor.
No, it's very good. My ears.
Yes. So for abusive sexual contact, there are two elements: that the accused committed sexual contact upon another person, and the accused did so by bodily harm. Under abusive sexual contact, bodily harm is any offensive touching, however slight, including non-consensual sexual act or contact. Battery, here, all that was required was that the accused did bodily harm to another person, Mrs. B.G., and that the bodily harm was done with unlawful force or violence. As previously stated, unlawful force or violence is that they wrongfully caused the contact, and there was no legally cognizable reason that existed that would excuse or justify that contact. Now, although consent is not an actual element in the statute, as charged, they had to prove the offensive nature of the touching, which put the appellant on notice. The government was also required to prove that Mrs. VG did not consent to appellant placing his hands between Mrs. VG's thighs. Therefore, although the elements are not precisely lined up, appellant was placed on notice because of how the specification was charged.
So how are you getting the unlawful force requirement? How are you fitting it in there to make it
that it was wrongful contact. And the wrongful contact, although not a direct synonym of offensive, it would have to be wrongful in this context. Or it would have had to be offensive in this context, my apologies.
Any unconsented to touching is, well, wrongful contact, but force.
I'm sorry, say again?
Any unconsented to touching.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is force.
In this context, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, that's what I'm asking.
So we should not view the word force in its layperson's understanding? Because, as you noted, unlawful force is defined at some point as an act of force done without legal justification or excuse. So your position is that any type of touching constitutes force?
For the Article 128, yes, Your Honor, because unlawful force doesn't require physical harm.
Then why, in terms of the statutory scheme that Congress would have had, they had aggravated sexual assault and included unlawful force. So you're saying that Congress, when it had aggravated sexual assault, that it was superfluous for them to include unlawful force there?
If I understand your question correctly, it's unlawful force for the different grades, or I guess severity, of the Article 120 offenses. Well, unlawful force would be bodily harm in itself would actually be a subset of unlawful force in the context of Article 120s, in that the bodily harm or the offensive touching would be at a minimum what would be required for unlawful force, and then it would just be a matter of degree between the abuse of sexual contact to, I guess, unlawful force is used in rape.
Well, unlawful force implies the existence of lawful force, which I presume in this context is a consented to touching.
Or any justification or reason.
Well, yeah, or some legal justification for touching.
Yes.
But in fact, the government's position to shoehorn this in there is basically that force is not force as normally understood, but any unconsented to touching, however slight. And the harm is not harm in the normally accepted sense, but simply the experience of being touched. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, because also when comparing and contrasting the Article 128 from the Article 120 offense, when discussing unlawful force, it's also discussing the victim's inability to overcome that force, which is why it is the more severe offenses or the higher grade, usually rape offenses that we're looking at when discussing unlawful force.
Can I just replow this ground a little bit? Now, Supreme Court in Yates said that when it comes to a statutory scheme, court should not interpret the statute so that any element becomes superfluous. Here, we've got aggravated sexual contact that explicitly uses as an element unlawful force. Then below that, we have abusive sexual contact where unlawful force doesn't appear. So why should we not, following Supreme Court in Yates, say that as part of this statutory scheme, Congress did not intend unlawful force to be part of abusive sexual contact?
Again, Your Honor, insofar as it is not a perfect lineup between abusive sexual contact and battery, for the purposes of interpreting the LIO for this, it's just whether or not appellant was placed on notice and whether he knew what he was defending against. Although it lacked the words that were usually seen in aggravated sexual assault, appellant would still be on notice of the offense.
And I understand your point there, but do you recognize my point about we have to follow Supreme Court? Supreme Court says when there's statutory scheme, we're not supposed to interpret it so that we're rendering any part of it superfluous. Why isn't it superfluous in the aggravated sexual contact in context if it is including unlawful force and something that a lower gradation of that already has that in it when it's not explicitly stated? Do you understand my concern?
I do, Your Honor. Perhaps that's I am attempting not to hedge, Your Honor. However, the
no,
specification
fine.
Was unlawful touching and
sure.
Not the force. Arguably, the military judge was aware of the potential for this, but it was, as found guilty, it was unlawful touching and not the unlawful force. Yet still following the battery spec.
Would you be willing, please, to address the issue of harmlessness?
I'm sorry, but
harmlessness?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, defense was on notice of a theory that appellant committed the offensive touching of placing his hands between Mrs. BG's thighs in order to effectuate the sexual contact of touching Mrs. BG's genitalia or rubbing on top of her. Now, although the appellant did not argue lack of consent, this could be due to the statements that he already made to CID and to his wife. However, this does not mean that he did not know what he had to defend against, since he specifically asked for the mistake of fact instruction of battery and provided a definition for unlawful touching that required intent or culpable negligence. Appellant's defense was multi-tiered. First, he attacked Mrs. Beege's ability to perceive because of the alcohol she consumed that evening, as well as her waking up to him touching her. Second, he attempted to explain away the statement he made to CID, specifically that he placed his hands between her legs because his hands were cold and that he could not find a blanket. He then tried to use appellant's confessions to his wife to build his accident defense because he originally told her that if his hands were near her legs, but that he was asleep. And then after his CID statement, he told his wife that his hands were between his thighs, or that he was, Appellant's wife said that he was more willing to say that his hands were between her thighs. And then finally, he attempted to show a lack of DNA on Mrs. Beege's leggings as dispositive on that issue. That if he were to touch or to rub that area, there would be DNA on his leggings that evening. So that, again, although the defense was not circled around lack of consent, given the evidence that they had to defend against, and knowing that they had to defend against the offense of touching, he forwarded an accident theory instead. Pending your questions. This court
Thank you, counsel. Oh, good.
This court should affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, I'd like to begin with making two observations about error and the nature of an LIO. Not every touch is an abuse of sexual contact, and not every touch is an assault consummated by a battery. Both of these offenses require an additional element beyond a harmful or offensive touch to be a crime. Abusive sexual contact requires that the offensive touch be a sexual contact, and assault consummated by a battery requires that the offensive touch be by means of unlawful force or violence with non-consent. And the very fact that the panel had to add the word unlawfully into the charge in order to true it up with the purported LIO of Article 128 demonstrates why this was not an LIO as charged. Moving on to the prejudice analysis, my colleague across the aisle has stated that the appellant had the opportunity to explain this away as an accident and to put on DNA evidence. All of these things were directed to at the question of whether or not he touched the genital area of Mrs. BG. The DNA was specific to the genital area. The legs were never tested for DNA because that's not what was litigated. What was litigated is whether or not there was a sexual contact. And further, the appellant was prejudiced because, contrary to the government's version of events here, the appellant did not personally, certainly did not personally try to explain this away because he did not testify in his own defense. And he exercised the choice not to testify in his own defense after the judge had explained that in the judge's view this, before the judge had explained in the judge's view this was an LIO. And so he had already made his choice. Had he the opportunity to testify in his own defense with notice of what he had to defend against, that he had to explain not only that he did not touch the genital area of Mrs. BG, but also why his touching of the legs was not unlawful under the circumstances, he could have exercised that right. But he was deprived of that because he lacked notice. Now, it may be helpful to keep in mind an example of a situation where you have a abusive sexual contact that does not involve unlawful force or violence. And it's this. You have the situation where at an office or some other place, typically a place of work, you have people in confined quarters or confined spaces. And one person, we'll call them the accused, places themselves in a position where another person has no choice but to brush past them in a way where there will be a sexual contact. Essentially, they are not initiating the contact, but they are causing the contact by some other means. And that is, and if that is done to arouse or gratify sexual desire or to abuse or humiliate based off of the body parts in question, that would be an abusive sexual contact, but it would not be an assault consummated by a battery. And that's an important distinction here. The government, it is in the government's interest to be able to charge that situation for what it is, an abusive sexual contact. And losing the relative sort of prosecutorial consolation prize of assault consummated by a battery if you fail to prove up the sexual contact is not what should be driving the policy here. What should be driving the policy is what Congress wanted to get at, which was the wrongful sexual contact. That's what was disproven in this case, or at least what the appellant was acquitted of in this case. Finally, to Judge Olson's point about the rule against surplusage, the argument that this court would have to read in surplusage to a statute is bolstered by the fact that by including the definition of the definition of bodily harm, that bodily harm may be an non-consensual sexual contact, it suggests that either the non-consensual sexual contact part is surplusage, or Congress should have said any non-consensual touching. But that's not what Congress said. Congress said non-consensual sexual contact. And unless this court is to read that as surplusage, in addition to Judge Olson's former point, this court should find that this was not an LAO as charged. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Court thanks Counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 2:55.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 2:55.